Hi, everyone. Dan Cassidy here. Welcome back to the CIO Fixed Income Roundtable podcast series here on the UBS Market Moves podcast channel. Joining us for this month's roundtable, glad to welcome members from CIO's Fixed Income team for the Americas. We do have joining us Letty Zamaitis, Barry McAlinden, Frank Saleo, as well as Sadeep Mukherjee. Joining us to moderate today's roundtable, glad to welcome back Head of Taxable Fixed Income Strategy for the Americas, Leslie Falconio. So with that, Leslie, I'll pass it over to you to lead today's roundtable. Welcome back.
Thank you, Dan. I appreciate it. Yeah, I'm actually looking forward for today because not only are we 5 days away from the quarter end, and it's hard to believe that we are entering the last quarter of the year because it's been as quickly as this year has seemed to go by, it definitely has been one that has been met with bouts of volatility. But on the fixed income side, we've seen a lot of recovery over the past several months, even from those sectors that have lagged. And from the perspective of the CIO, I mean, recently we've reached our year-end target of 10-year Treasury yield, which is 4%. We saw that, you know, right before the Fed meeting last week. And while we were anticipating a 25 basis point cut from the Fed, and they delivered, and by the way, we are anticipating, you know, another two cuts this year, followed by one cut in the first quarter of 2026, what we learned from the Fed, you know, is a lot of disparity in the sense that this is still a meeting-by-meeting type of venue. They're still very data-dependent. We're seeing a lot of divergence in terms of where the Fed believes what we call that neutral rate, if you will, where you're neither accommodative nor restrictive, will be. And more importantly, one of the things that we discussed as well is that, you know, prior to the Fed meeting, the fixed income market being forward-looking and a bit of a speculative market, once again had a tendency to be a little bit overzealous in terms of the pricing, you know, pricing these cuts, a bit overzealous in terms of thinking that consumer demand might start to deplete given the fact that the labor market is starting to weaken. But, you know, we had second quarter revisions again to GDP, which were higher. You know, we still have a capital markets that remain incredibly wide open with a lot of investor demand. And we also are dealing with a lot of tight spreads within the fixed income market, although carry, the driver of total return, still remains. So I really want to kick off with one of the sectors that has had a great recovery, you know, over the past several months, and one that, you know, is incredibly important to UBS and our advisors and clients, and that's to go to Frank Saleo and the preferred market. So, Frank, I just wanted to just touch on, you know, given the volatility that we've seen from the preferred market, you know, in 2025, you know, how has it reacted to sort of like the Fed and how the capital markets have remained open? Also, too, you know, we're hard to believe, but we're heading into the fourth quarter. How do you see the performance for the remainder of the year?
Yeah, definitely. Thank you very much, Leslie. I appreciate it. Yeah, you know, as we come to the end of the third quarter year, preferreds are having a very good year, both the $25 par, what we call the retail preferred sector, and the $1,000 par institutional preferred sector as well. And as we look at those subsector returns between those two categories, it's really the $25 par preferreds that have had a tremendous recovery, as you alluded to a moment ago. And looking at the performance of the $25 pars versus the $1,000 par preferred, it's almost like a strange version of the old tortoise and the hare story. But in this version of the story, the race is a tie so far. You know, all year, those institutional $1,000 par preferreds have been delivering slow and steady returns month after month. But more recently, over the past 4 months, the retail $25 par preferreds have been dramatically outperforming. As a matter of fact, since May 31st, if we just look at the summer months to date, since May 31st, $25 par preferreds are up just about 9%. But that follows significant underperformance at the start of the year. So if we look at year-to-date performance at the end of May, the $1,000 par preferreds were up 2.5% year-to-date, while the $25 par preferreds were down 2.5% at that point. And looking at, you know, this dichotomy, really the underperformance at the start of the year and then the outperformance more recently, it's somewhat more attributable to the higher correlation between $25 par preferreds and stocks. And these returns, this return experience of the $25 par retail preferreds, seems to coincide with the S&P 500 experience this year being, you know, at the cusp of a bear market in early April and then subsequently rallying very strongly during the summer months and consistently making brand new highs even as we head to the end of September here. So after underperforming $1,000 pars at the start of the year, $25 par preferreds have closed the gap. And overall, both the sector overall is up by about 7% year to date, a little bit more for the thousands, a little bit yet less for the 25s, but just about 7% year to date overall, which is really pretty good. So I've been making the point all year that it's important to have exposure to both of these subsectors and that the institutional preferreds can really help investors get better or help to try to get better risk-adjusted returns and more complete exposure to preferred sector. The point I've been trying to make is that by adding $1,000 pars to the mix, preferred investors may be able to improve overall risk-adjusted performance by reducing those return correlations with other sectors, including common stocks. But you don't want to fully discount or fully disregard the $25 par preferreds either, because these retail preferreds, you know, they tend to have fixed rate coupons. Most of them are trading at discounts, in some cases steep discounts to their par value. And most importantly, these $25 par retail preferreds have longer duration. And now that the Fed has started to cut rates again, it's important to have some of that long duration exposure. You know, traditionally $25 par preferreds have what they call negative convexity, and that just means their sensitivity to higher yield increases as those yields increase. But at this point, convexity for the $25 par preferred is close to zero. Their duration is pretty much as high as it's going to get. So a reduction in interest rates from here or a reduction in market yields from here should provide a nice tailwind for the $25 par preferreds in the months ahead. Having said that, as we think about the drivers of return from here for the remainder of the year, as you asked, Leslie, I think sector valuation will remain a limiting constraint. You alluded to that at the start of this call, the tight spreads that investors have been dealing with, struggling with, the challenge of tighter spreads in fixed income broadly. That's been the case all year for most fixed income sectors. We've had credit spreads in high yields reach historic lows. Investment-grade credit spreads are, I keep seeing headlines, they're near 25-year lows, 27-year lows. I know we're going to hear from Letty and Barry on this in a few minutes, but for preferreds, tighter credit premiums are just not likely to drive returns from here. They're already pretty tight, so it's unlikely we're going to see them compress even further. There's just no catalyst on the horizon that would lead to credit premiums to tighten even further. So, although we expect the interest rate environment to remain favorable, especially now that the Fed has begun to cut rates again, it leaves interest rate trends to be the tailwind. But again, they're not likely to provide much of a meaningful tailwind. The CIO did publish our latest forecast for the 10-year Treasury yields. We're looking for them to go to about 3.75 a year from now. As you mentioned, the 10-year Treasury hit your 4% target very recently. So, you know, there'll be a bias towards lower interest rates from here, but it's just not enough to really provide a meaningful tailwind for preferreds. And from a valuation standpoint, frankly, that's all already been fully discounted. That environment really is fully discounted into current preferred valuation. So to sum up, Leslie, I'd say overall, there's minimal capacity in current preferred credit premiums to provide a cushion against any unexpected drive towards significantly higher market yields from here, whether it's from unexpectedly higher rates or wider credit spreads. And frankly, I wouldn't be surprised to see a pullback between now and year end. You know, it's unlikely that those consistent monthly gains that we've been seeing since the summer, month after month after month, it's unlikely we're going to see that continue. We could see more choppy performance as we head into 2026, more like the two steps forward, two steps back, or at least one step back type of performance pattern that we see from time to time. And that's what I expect in the months ahead, Leslie. Turn it back to you.
Yep. Thank you, Frank. And actually, you know, that was a great, you know, overview. And one of the things that you emphasized, which I couldn't agree with you more, is the diversification part. And you know, as we've all discussed as a team, we know that fixed income spreads, you know, are tight overall as a sector. And there's, you know, the opportunity set in terms of spreads is not necessarily the widest that we've seen. But it's important to note as well is that while we are anticipating cuts from the Fed, you know, with CIO's point of view, that these are non-recessionary cuts. So when we have these types of non-recessionary cuts, it doesn't necessarily mean as the Fed starts to cut, and, you know, from very high Fed funds rate, that you're going to have this necessarily really large, you know, blowout in spread. So while we could see slight spread widening, they're not going to fall off a cliff by any stretch. But the diversification part is definitely the key to any portfolio. And one of the things that, you know, as I go over to Letty, is that when we see in the marketplace, just even with tight spreads, how open, I would say, the capital markets are, and how, you know, eager investor demand is. So, Letty, when I turn it over to you, when we talk about, like, high yield, we know spreads are incredibly tight, but that investor demand seems to be there, even with the dislocation and the disparity we are seeing among different credit classes. So, again, I want to sort of touch base to you in terms of how you viewed the Fed, you know, the current environment, and what you're thinking about going into the latter part of the year.
Well, if I could just use one word for high yield, I would say that it's just been resilient. We got the news at the Fed and during Jackson Hole it was possibly going to be easing. We saw spreads tighten even further, up by 42 basis points. And to put this in context, the average over the past 20 years for spreads has been around 500, and we're at 271. So we're at historical spreads. I don't see much spread compression from here. Again, we're at, you know, historical lows. Also, we've seen yields also come down from the beginning of August. It was around 715. We're at a 660 now. And, you know, it's like, you know, it's a 60 basis points of spreads being much lower. We're at yields right now that we haven't seen since April of 22. The CIO feels, going forward, probably, you know, mid-year, our target for spreads is 350. But I think that, you know, that could be choppy. We've got very positive news in the economy, such as today. It comes much stronger than expected. We have a revision in GDP, you know, up to 3.8. There was an increase in personal consumption. Durable goods was up. We're expecting a negative number. It came up to close to 3%. Jobless claims comes lower. So I think, as you mentioned earlier, it's going to be very data dependent on what happens. But all this up news on the economy is very positive for high yield. High yield also has a very low duration. It's at 2.8 years, where the average typically is 4 to 5. And issuance is the biggest story. We're at $43 billion this month, the highest of the year. And there's been just $10 billion just this month alone, which shows you how much demand there is for investors, especially when we're expecting, you know, the Fed to cut and, you know, companies are still issuing. So we have, for technicals, you know, it's very strong for high yield, and it's supportive as, you know, investors keep buying it. Default rates, also, it's at a 1.3. And although we've had the tariff noise and geopolitical, you know, noise, high yield's still, you know, been resilient. We're expecting maybe 2 to 3% next year. But again, that would have to be if the economy, you know, slows down, because right now the companies are very strong. They cleaned up their balance sheets during the pandemic. And also one thing that has improved default rates is that the typical triple C's that used to go to high yield, they're going to private credit now. So that also has helped significantly on the default rate. As to performance, what do I see? It's performed extremely well this year. High yield is up 7.3%, with the winners being telecom over 10% and healthcare at 9.5%. The laggard has been retail around 4.7, but that's, you know, due to the tariff noise there. High yield has beat loans by 270 basis points. You know, loans are only up 4.6. From now to the end of the year, I feel it's going to be a carry trade. I don't think you're going to get any returns from the spread compression, but we could see another 1% to 2%. I wouldn't be surprised to year end, especially if we don't have the slowdown and we keep getting these positive economy numbers like we did today. And for right now, my recommendation is, you know, high yield, again, it's a carry trade. But if you wanted to put in, like, fresh new money, I may wait to see if it gets a little bit wider than here because, you know, it is rich right now. But lower rates also, as the Fed cuts, is also going to be more supportive for high yield. So you may want to, like, you know, inch in there. As for loans, that's been more of a risk off as of late with the expectation that, you know, rates are going to be cut, but still that's yielding 8.6. We have a neutral view on loans. So I think that's also a good thing. And it's also good, like, you know, like Frank mentioned, to diversify, you know, by having these different sectors in your portfolio, you're diversifying and you're getting, you know, these are the riskiest part, you know, riskier than IG, but you're getting a good pickup and a good carry.
So
especially with the expectations to lock in yields now before they cut further.
Yeah, thankfully. And then, you know, one thing that you mentioned, particularly with the high yield market, and I couldn't agree with you more, it's a great word, is resilience. And that's definitely what the high yield market has witnessed, particularly since, you know, the April wides that we saw during that month of volatility. They seem to have not only recovered, but they've recovered and really stayed in a fairly narrow range. So, you know, we've had this resilience within high yield for quite some time now. And to your point, while yields, you know, the yields worse are not, you know, ample compared to history, you know, they still represent very good carry versus alternatives. Now, one of the things I had mentioned in, you know, the beginning of the call was when I talked about fixed income, was those such as high yield that's been, you know, fairly resilient and has tightened for several months, and those that have recently, sectors that have recently recovered, which brings me over to you, Sudeep, to talk about what we've seen, like, you know, in the muni market and talk about recovery. So, I want to ask you, how has sort of the shift in Fed policy impacted the muni market, and what do you see in terms of the end of the year?
Yeah, sure. Happy to comment on that, and thanks for having me on the call, Leslie. So before I get to fourth quarter, just a kind of a backdrop of where munis are. So the immediate reaction of munis to the Fed cut was relatively muted. Yields didn't change all that much. However, over the last 1 month, 45 days, in part due to anticipation of the cuts, the rally in rates coinciding with a pullback in supply from very elevated levels, the muni market did rally very strongly. Munis were one of the best performers in fixed income over the last month or so. But that said, the total story, the whole story did not change all that much. Total return of the index is now in positive territory, but still significantly lagging other fixed income assets. Also, the other theme of the market that we've seen this year, munis are generally less volatile than treasuries and corporates, but not so this year, as munis have seen unusually high vol and driven by those supply pressures, and we'll come to that in a minute. So underperformance and high vol, but the silver lining and the corollary to that is opportunity still persists in the muni market. Yields are still high. Index tax equivalent yield at 6.1%. California, New York in-state bonds at about 7.5%, still hovering near that 15-year high. So a lot of opportunity in the market still. The AAA curve did bull flatten over the last month or so. The theme obviously has been steepening this year, so that was a welcome change. But the curve still remains very steep, particularly in the 10 to 30-year area, both relative to its own historical average as well as to the treasury curve. So longer duration munis for longer investment horizons still remains a very attractive proposition, a thing that we highlighted about a month back. But coming to fourth quarter, the drivers of total return will be a combination of flows, technicals, and rates. Let me just comment on those individually. Flows have been strong since the April sell-off, and historically they have been very strong into a Fed easing cycle. This time is no different in our view. So we do expect flows to generally remain strong, albeit they're never in a straight line. With respect to technicals, the picture is more mixed. October to present some challenges to the market. Technicals are weakening as supply is rising again, just as reinvestment demand is declining. So that net supply, as what we call demand-supply balance, or technicals in short, will weaken or expected to weaken in October, but should improve later in November and December. So that's a bit of a mixed picture. Rates, I think Frank put it well, muni index performance is really driven by 10-year and 20-year treasury rates when you look at key rate durations. 10-year is fairly close to our year-end target. It actually reached a target and has backed up a little bit. So from that perspective, we don't see a whole lot of price appreciation potential in the near term. That's limited in our view. And finally, you know, I haven't talked about credit. Credit this year has not played a major role in performance. Lower quality, triple B and high yield spreads remain compressed. That's the same theme as I've already talked about. Relative to historical averages, we don't see compelling opportunity from a risk-reward perspective, especially given that the labor market is weakening in lower-rated credits. But to summarize, longer horizon opportunities persist in the muni market, and we strongly believe that 12-month forward returns from where the yields are, where the slope is, and where flows are headed are all supportive of performance. Near term, there could be some potential weakness in technicals, There could be some pullback in the market, but that would represent a buy-the-dip opportunity for longer-term investors. So 4Q outlook is somewhat mixed. We do expect a year-end rally, but October could present challenges, but that those 12-month, 15-month, or 18-month forward total returns look fairly attractive, driven by income returns in terms of total return performance. Let me hand it back to you, Leslie.
Thank you, Sudeep. And yeah, you know, I agree in the sense that given, you know, not just in terms of the muni and, you know, potential short-term technical and the performance that we might see going into the end of the year, but I also believe that, you know, given how well all fixed income is done, you might see these pockets of spread widening, and I agree with the buy the dip and looking at that as an opportunistic period to actually add to your fixed income, given the fact, again, that we're not looking, that we are looking for the Fed to cut, but we are not looking for a recession over the next year. But, you know, one sector that, you know, has done very well and continues to have, you know, large demand both domestically and abroad is the corporate market, which leads me over to you, Barry. And I know you just recently wrote a great piece in terms of discussing the impact of deregulation and how this might, you know, affect, you know, the IG corporate market, particularly when it comes to financials. So, again, I just want to, from a manager of a sector that has done incredibly well and has had tremendous demand, how do you see, you know, if at all, any change with what the Fed is doing or how they might perform, how investor-grade corporates might perform into the end of the year?
Yeah, thanks, Leslie. So, I mean, the main headline is that investment-grade spreads are their tightest levels, you know, since the late 90s, as mentioned on the call. But, you know, that said, they're only about 7 basis points tighter on a year-to-date basis. So, you know, they've been tight all year, so really nothing's deviated, you know, from what we've seen before this. We think that the tight spreads are warranted when you think about the strong fundamental environment where we've been in a very good earnings backdrop. You know, EBITDA growth, that's a main metric that we look at for credit fundamentals. That's exceeding debt growth. So credit metrics are going to be in check, you know, as long as, you know, that's persisting, which, you know, in CIO, we do think that the earnings environment will persist into next year pretty well. And then, you know, when you look at the technicals, you know, also making headlines just this week is the record amount of issuance that we've seen during the month of September. So total volume of investment grade corporates is tallying up to be about over 200 billion, currently around 200 billion with, you know, some time left to go in the month. That's on pace to be the sixth largest issuance month on record. I think the reason why you're seeing this is a combination of this historically tight spread environment, you know, plus a window where, you know, especially after Jackson Hole, you know, we did see rates come down, you know, compared to where they had been over, you know, the past, you know, couple of years, right? We've been in a higher rate environment than we've been in now. So, it's a good opportunity for issuers to tap these markets. You know, there is some opportunistic, I think, front loading. I think the street's looking for October, November issuance in December, you know, to be lower than where we are now. But the demand is there. You know, a lot of it in investment grade is automatic. There's just this built-in institutional demand that occurs in the market. So, you know, I think the technical picture is fine, but I think I would say fundamentally, you know, that's probably what matters more. And, you know, that said, we think that the tight level of spread, you know, is warranted in this environment. You know, look, that said, obviously, you know, the trajectory for spreads is going to be wider than tighter, you know, over time. You know, what drives that widening, you know, we'll see. But we don't expect, you know, given kind of the risks that are known in the marketplace right now, we're not expecting any sharp widening of credit spreads to take place. So definitely as we move into the fourth quarter, still looking for a lot of the same. You know, where you have that the return from investment-grade corporates likely to be derived from the coupon component, you know, plus just general fluctuation, mostly on the treasury yield side, we think, probably more so than credit spreads, which we think should stay, you know, pretty firmly range-bound. So, you know, the outlook for IG, I think, actually gets a little bit better if you compare what's happening to cash yields, where, like, for example, the 3-month treasury bill did dip below 4% recently, you know, the first time since we've been in this hiking cycle that that's happened. And, you know, as that differential persists, we expect that decompression of cash yields will continue to decline as the Fed, cuts rates. And the IG yield, though, we really kind of see a floor, in that low 4% coupon handle, probably not likely dipping below 3%, based on our outlooks, for rates and spreads. So I think there's still going to be an appeal, for moving out the curve into investment grade corporate. And just to wrap up, though, obviously, with this strong performance comes a more challenging environment to seek out relative value. Within the corporate sector, there's really just two industry sectors that are a bit wider than they've been historically. That's regional banks and utilities. So those are kind of two pockets where spreads are actually wider than the 10-year averages. But otherwise, everything's really tight. And, we've been recommending basically that intermediate belly part of the curve. I think that's also supported by the fact that if you think about how much credit spread you pick up for going out beyond 10 years, that's actually historically flat. So you don't pick up much more than about 10 basis points. So, it's much longer duration, for going out further beyond 10 years, plus you're not picking up credit spread, supportive of our view to kind of stick with the intermediate maturities, for the best total return potential, and for buy and hold to maturity investors. Still really like kind of that 1 to 10 year ladder strategy where you can just clip that coupon along the way. And then I also mentioned though beyond the investment grade corporate sector, we do see better relative value. And Leslie, this is driven by your views in higher quality segments in the agency MBS and CMBS securitized market. So if you are looking for where there's other better pockets of value beyond investment grade corporates, you could seek out agency MBS and CMBS to consider that as well.
Thank you, Barry. And listen, Barry, there's two things that you said that I think are really important. And I don't think investors actually realize, and you touched upon this, and I have many times as well, is that they see the headline risk of spread tightening, but to your point, year to date, spreads aren't really materially tighter since they were from the beginning of the year. And one of the reasons why this was is that after the election, the market was pricing in a lot of this U.S. exceptionalism, so they came into the year tight. That's the first thing. I think the second thing, Barry, that you said, which I think is really important, is that while spreads are tight, if the fundamentals support this, then they will likely stay within this range. And remember, spreads are simply the risk premium that investors are expecting given a certain risk, whether it's, say for IG credit risk. And if the fundamentals support low risk, whether it's low leverage, better corporate balance sheets, an outperforming equity market, then spreads will stay in this range. But it's not spreads that are the tailwind to total return for fixed income. It's compounding income. So I do think that, when we go forward, fixed income and both equity have had a very good year. It's the exact opposite, luckily, of what we saw in 2022. There's no question that we will have, pockets of volatility and, small bouts of vulnerability. But overall, we're going to look at that kind of movement as an opportunity to buy the dip, assuming that our forecast for growth is correct, meaning that we do anticipate growth slow. That is the consensus, but we were not anticipating a recession. We do expect the Fed to continue their cutting cycle. But again, data dependence and, each meeting will still remain. So you're going to keep seeing a little bouts of volatility from very low levels. But overall, I think for everyone on this call, we would agree that fixed income overall is at a very good year. We continue to expect it in 2026 to be a strong performer. But as everyone on this call has really focused on, the performance driver is going to be driven by compounding income, not necessarily movements in rates, and obviously not things from like spreads. So with that, I thank everyone very much for being on this call, and we'll see you in November. Thanks so much.
Thank you for tuning in. Be sure to visit ubs.com/studios to view the entire UBS Studios suite of podcast channels, along with our video offerings, such as UBS Trending. You can also follow us on Instagram for content highlights at UBS Trending. UBS Studios is part of the UBS Chief Investment Office within UBS Global Wealth Management. Visit ubs.com/CIO to view the latest research.
UBS Chief Investment Office's investment views are prepared and published by the Global Wealth Management Business of UBS AG or its affiliate, UBS. This material has no regard to the specific investment objectives, financial situation, or particular needs of any specific recipient and is published for informational purposes only. As a firm providing wealth management services to clients globally, UBS AG and its subsidiaries offer both investment advisory services and brokerage services. Investment advisory services and brokerage services are separate and distinct, differ in material ways, and are governed by different laws and separate arrangements. In the USA, UBS Financial Services, Inc. is a subsidiary of UBS AG and a member of FINRA SIPC. For information, please visit our website at ubs.com/workingwithus. For a full legal disclaimer applicable to the independent investment views produced by UBS, please visit our website at ubs.com/CIO-disclaimer.